Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Beyond the Scenes, the podcast that goes deeper into segments and topics that aired on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. This week, we're taking a look back at some of the many amazing guests and experts we've been lucky to have on the program. I've had everybody from members of Congress to medical professionals, even professional singers and songwriters. Now let's take a look at some of our favorite moments with our guests who provided us with their wisdom and expertise. The first expert we have up is Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who talks to us about the pink tax and why certain goods and services cost women more than they do men. The same thing that a man buy and a woman buy, it costs more. It's ridiculous. And she was even kind enough to give us a little show and tell. Let's check it out. Congresswoman Speier, welcome to Beyond the Scenes.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for letting me be a man in this woman-centric topic.
Too bad we don't rule the world, though, just because we're ruling this particular podcast. That's the problem. We're not ruling the world yet.
I would be honest. I felt uncomfortable hosting this episode. I was like, maybe Desi need to guest host. I don't want to get in trouble.
You're doing great, Roy.
Okay, before we do anything, we have to define what the issue is. So, Desi, Stacy, let's start off the top. What is the pink tax?
Well, the pink tax refers to the markup on goods and services that are specifically being targeted to women.
Gender price discrimination. So, Roy, everything you buy is cheaper than the same products we want to buy.
Okay, so if we both bought deodorant and mine is man deodorant and yours is woman deodorant, same brand, you're paying more than me, is what you're saying, Stacey.
It's more expensive for us to smell good than for you.
Which is why Stacy and I refuse to smell good.
Yeah, you're lucky this is on Zoom, Roy, because you don't want to smell this.
Okay.
They won't even let us back in the studio.
Yes.
Okay.
Nothing to do with COVID.
So, Congresswoman, I'm sorry. I apologize for both of them. Why does the pink tax exist? And more importantly, how do manufacturers and retailers justify this tax?
Well, the pink tax exists because it's a form of gender discrimination. It's not just about pink. It's about the fact that women's products cost more than men's products when they are basically identical. It is important for us to address this because, as we all know, women still make less than men. For every dollar a man earns, a woman makes 82 cents. If you look at women of color, it's even more egregious. And that's real money when everything is said and done.
Are there other examples of this other than deodorant? Because I'll be honest, as a man, this isn't something that you would normally think about because you're not buying a lot of women's items unless you're a committed, strong man in a relationship like I am. So you're not aware of this. Give me what other items other than deodorant? I have heard that women get worse deals on cars.
But let me give you some products that kind of make the case. All right.
Okay.
So this is Dove deodorant for men and women. And as you can see here, for a 4-pack, a woman's going to pay $19.39. The man's going to pay $13.58. But that's just deodorant. Let's move on. How about probiotics for women? $32.79 for a man.
All right, this is like The Price is Right. Let me guess the
it
next.
It is. The price is wrong, though. That's the problem.
Always so wrong. So
The Price is Right needs to have a gender separate episode.
Yes.
Maybe so, huh? So look at this. These are bibs, right? Bibs for boys, bibs for girls. A dollar more for the girls' bibs. No, wait, there's more.
What?
There's more.
Oh, my God.
These are kids' diapers. The kids' diapers, $37 for the girl. $33 for the boy, but I'll show you what? The same discrimination for
it's
adult
just
diapers.
Congresswoman.
That's not, and boys have more happening to fill out diaper space. So really, square footage, it should cost more for the men, right?
But probably because they need more absorbance. They need more absorbent material, so it should cost more, right? Yeah. Now, we did this same study 2 or 3 years ago. And they were egregious around children's toys. So I had my interns do this just this week, and this is what they found online at retailers throughout the country. So this is up-to-date, current. So what are we going to do about it?
How does price discrimination add another layer to the wage inequality that women also deal with?
Well, it's yet another blow. When I did the service review in 1996, we found out through the Assembly Office of Research in California that women were paying $1,400 in a gender tax every year, more than men. So imagine, on top of the fact that we're in a she session, not a recession, more women are out of work than men. And there's 1.3 million women who have left the workforce since COVID hit and have not returned, in part because of the lack of childcare. This number is the highest number of women not employed since 1991. So you couple that with women out of work, women getting paid less than men, and on top of that, products and services are costing them more. There ought to be a law, and that's why I've introduced the Pink Tax Repeal Act, and we have 51 co-sponsors on it now.
This issue, this pink tax issue, when we talk about the say the word again, a she session?
A she session instead
she
of a
session.
Recession.
I like it. Does the she session strike women equally, or even within that, is there additional inequities based on race?
Oh, no question. It's more egregious for women of color, African-American women, Latina women, and the amount of loss in income is the greatest for Latina women.
So your Pink Tax Repeal Act, it's bipartisan, and basically we're trying to get all of these manufacturers and retailers on the same plane to basically say, if it's something as simple as deodorant and you keep both of y'all from being musty, it should be the same price.
That's right. And unless you can prove.
I'm sure it's not worded like that. I'm sure you worded it more professionally. You probably said FTC and Attorney General, and you used a lot of the proper words.
That's right. We did use more proper words to basically say, if you don't play by these rules, you're going to be sued.
And so then the bill has 48 co-sponsors right now. Has there been any pushback that you've seen so far on your proposal?
The numbers have grown. It's now at 51. I've talked to the chairwoman of the subcommittee. She loves the bill, and we're going to have a hearing on it and hopefully get it to the House floor within the next few months. And we can credit you with helping me get it over the top.
Desi.
Yes.
Desi.
No credit here.
What role can consumers play in provoking change? And by consumers, I mean men. You know what I'm talking about. We're the problem. I know.
You are the problem. Well, the problem is that it's not illegal in most states to charge more for services based on gender or charge more for products. You should not be discriminating on goods and services based on gender. It should be based on the time it takes to do a service and what's in the product. Women pay about 40% more to get their hair cut than men do, and they pay about 60% more at the dry cleaners for the same service for the same item. And then for car repairs, they pay about 30% more. Now, in California, back in the 90s, I had legislation passed that was signed into law that said for services, you had to base it not on gender, but on the amount of time it takes to provide that service. For instance, I timed the last time I got my hair cut. It took 10 minutes. And I watched a man getting his hair cut, and it took longer. So if we do base it on time, then I think you're going to see the tables turned a little bit, and then there'll be an outcry from you guys because you're going to be paying more for your $2 dry cleaning shirt.
When would you say that you all were first aware of a pink tax existing? because, you know, you got to figure you have a little bit of a blind spot to certain inequities. And then one day you just go, wait a minute. When was your wait a minute moment? Congresswoman, I'll start with you.
It was when I took my husband's Oxford shirts to the dry cleaner, and they were, you know, $1.50 a shirt. And my Oxford shirt costs, you know, $3.50 or $4. That's when I thought, wait a minute, something's wrong here.
I can remember when I first started shaving my legs around 6, 7 years old. I was a very hairy child. I was 13, 12, 13, somewhere around there. And my mom bought me a razor and some shaving cream. And I remember the Gillette razor being considerably more expensive than what men use. And my mom refusing to buy me that razor and also bought me a can of Barbasol, like the old school men's shaving cream. And so when I shave my legs, I just use the stuff for men. And I still, if I'm being honest, I still have an affinity for the smell of Barbasol.
That's why I just never shave my legs. Mine was, I went through a terrible phase where I had, we'll call it a pixie haircut, to be nice about it. And I went to a hair salon, and the girls' haircuts were like about $20 to $30 more. And I was like, why? I'm literally getting the same haircut as that guy in the chair. And I just at the time thought that they were just a really like sexist hair place. And they were like, oh, well, women, you know, you guys have more layers. I'm like, it's the exact same haircut. And then it wasn't until I went to your office and I was ashamed. I was like, oh my God, this is a thing, like another thing to add on top of everything else. So you opened my eyes, Congresswoman.
Good. We want to open the eyes of both men and women in this country to recognize that this is another form of discrimination that we've got to stamp out.
Big thank you to the Congresswoman Spear for giving us a little bit of her time. Our next expert after the break is going to talk to us about the way nurses have been treated during COVID. Well, actually, mistreated. It's Beyond the Scenes.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. You know what, man? That Price is Wrong segment was really eye-opening. CBS needs to develop that into a Price is Right spinoff. Hit me up, Drew Carey. I got nothing but time. Trevor got my number. Next up, I chat with the doctor of nursing, Dr. Christopher Freeze. Now, I know his name sounds like a bit of a supervillain, but I assure you, he's a hero in a white coat. I chatted with Christopher about how nurses have been coping during the pandemic, and he had some real eye-opening things to say about the treatment of nurses. Give me the clip. Dr. Freeze, you know, when you look at healthcare in the modern era in this country now, like it's not just about knowing your job from a techie, technical, IV, find the vein standpoint. You also, it seems that the job of nurse is a little bit part sociologist as well, where you have to be able to relate to people. And I would even argue that there might be a little small element of social work in trying to just connect with people on a normal human basis. But you have a lot of different confluences happening. What do you believe are the primary challenges for nurses and the healthcare system right now?
Well, how much time do we have right now? First, I want to say that each and every day, nurses are delivering exceptional care across the country. They are getting it done for their patients, technically, socially, physically. They are problem solving behind the scenes. They are, you know, I call it, you know, part technical, part psychology, part air traffic controller. And that's the part that a lot of people don't see. So a lot of excellent nursing care is still happening, but we're on the brink. And we've been on the brink for about almost 2 years now. So when we think about the priorities, what I'm really worried about is at some point, our public health officials will have a lower level of concern for COVID than they do right now. They will say, we're at a phase that we can, quote, manage this. We have an ability, you know, the case counts are very, very low. We're not seeing these big wide spikes that we're still seeing. And everybody's going to say, oh, great, problem solved, and they're going to walk away. And they're going to leave nurses in the lurch without solving the underlying structural things that are happening to nurses every day and have been happening for a decade. So my team's been studying nursing workplaces for 2 decades now. A couple things that I'm very worried about. One is executives are not spending enough time on understanding the working conditions of nurses and how they need to fix them. They're not listening to nurses and solving their problems.
Executives within the healthcare system.
Exactly right.
Okay, just making sure.
Executives in the healthcare system are not listening carefully to nurses' concerns and acting upon those concerns. When nurses tell you they have a problem, they have a problem. They're not making it up. And when nurses have problems in their workplaces, we've known that patients are more likely to die, patients are more likely to have complications, patients are more likely to have to stay longer in the hospital. None of us want any of that. So first is we have to have our healthcare executives listen deeply and carefully to nurses and work very strategically on those problems. Then we have a couple of structural things, not very sexy, but we still allow many nurses, as you point out, to work mandatory overtime. Their boss can come to them, they've worked a 12-hour shift, it's 5 o'clock at night, they've worked 10 hours nonstop, and their boss can come to them at 5 p.m. and say, guess what, you're staying another 4 hours. And we don't do that to pilots. Your pilot flies you from New York to L.A. They get off the plane and they go home and rest.
Truck drivers either.
And
truck drivers, mm-hmm. They track truck drivers to make sure they're not even cheating.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. So we've got a couple of structural things like that. We also have, well, guess what? We're running short on a nurse, so you're going to take another 1, 2, 3 patients. And right now in the COVID era, we're seeing that in the ICU. I've never heard of that in the ICU in 25 years of nursing. So executives have decided to put the labor problems on the backs of nurses rather than solving the underlying problem. And I think that problem predated COVID, and it's only gotten worse during COVID. So if we really focus on those issues, we're going to have a healthy, safe nursing workforce that can care for us during COVID and after COVID. And if we don't pay attention to that stuff, we're going to be in a whole world of hurt, and we're going to see more of the stuff that we're seeing now. Nurses leaving in droves, too many patients to care for, unsafe staffing, et cetera. It's a vicious cycle if we don't break the chain.
I'm going to ask a question that's going to seem morbid, but it's from a fiscal place. Why would the executives break the backs of the employees whose job it is to help keep the customer alive? Like, if we're just going base level, making money in healthcare, if people die, that is not good fiscally for business. So why would we create a place where the workers cannot do their job the right way? What is the advantage in an executive doing that? Like, if we said, they're not a sponsor. Let's just use Amazon, for example. Okay. Yeah, Amazon's going to pay you as little as possible and not put you in a union because it makes them more money. Overworking nurses doesn't make you more money. The patient is the patient. The cost is the cost. So why would you want the patient to die? Like, what are the advantages mm-hmm. in the executive infrastructure of a hospital in being assholes like this?
Well, I have a lot of friends who are executives, so let me put that on there. And I think a lot of them—
Not them. Really, they're cool. But yeah. Those other ones. Yeah.
You know who we mean.
those other people, right? So, you know, I think that, first of all, a lot of the executives are trying to do the right thing, but we don't have the incentives lined up. And I spoke about this earlier. So number one, when you unfortunately are in the hospital and you get a bill when you go home, do me a favor and look at your bill. And you tell me, this is a quiz for everybody listening, go take a look at that bill and tell me where the bill for nursing services is. You know where it is? Room and board. Nurses are part of the room and board, part of a hospital bill. So if you have cancer and I'm an oncology nurse and I am giving you expert care for your leukemia, and I'm in your room every hour drawing blood and checking your, and giving you blood products to save your life and giving you antibiotics and all that stuff, and the person next to you or the room down the hall has an appendix removed and they're there for 12 hours and I give them 2 Tylenol and send them on their way, the bill for the day is the same. So right now, nurses are widgets in the hospital. And they are the largest part of the hospital budget. And so when times get tough, guess where they're going to cut? Guess where they're going to cut the corner without nurses stepping up and saying, this is no longer safe. This is no longer acceptable. We need a different structure. And so it's a tricky thing. It's going to be hard to solve. But what executives can do right now is really listen carefully to what their nurses are telling them and act on it. And what they can do tomorrow is eliminate mandatory overtime, because that's unsafe and we know it's unsafe. And they can work carefully to get those numbers right so that we have an adequate number of nurses to care for the patients, because it's unsustainable. But the primary problem is we do not value either numerically or monetarily the kind of nursing care that patients in the U.S. need in hospitals.
One of the things that I found researching that, you know, really struck me was just, you know, not just the level of care, but just all of the different types of care that nurses do that I don't think we really think of, that, you know, it is drawing blood and it is giving medicine, but you're also helping patients shave. You know, the nurses are the ones holding the phones so people can talk to patients. Like, there's a lot of things that if you did put them on a hospital bill, it would probably look like a CVS receipt. You know, because you'd be like, oh, right, that's, look at all, you know, maybe we should start, you know, putting those on so people can actually understand that type of care.
Yeah.
Or talking to the doctor and the pharmacist when you're not even in the room to say, you just ordered an errant medication that's going to put this patient at risk. Do you really want to do that?
Yeah.
Or, you know, so there's all this work happening behind the scenes, this air traffic control function. Nobody sees it. And nobody's paying for it. It's just happening and it's part of my work. And so you can either have me overloaded where I'm trying to do that for too many planes, too many patients in this example, or we can do it in a way where I have the time and space to really care for patients or teach them about their new leukemia diagnosis or their new surgery, whatever they just had done. So you get what you pay for. And right now we're lumping this into room and board. It's basically a Hyatt bill. Sorry if they're a sponsor of yours, but you know, we don't, I love this idea of the CV, because if we did that for a nurse, what did you do for this patient for 12 hours? It would be a ticker tape parade.
Is there anything that the general public can do? Because so much of what you're talking about is, it seems to be, in my opinion, or just from my perspective, again, as a guy who only goes to hospitals to steal blankets.
You borrow them.
No, I don't take them back, Madeline. Don't clean it up for me. I steal them. These are very wonderful blankets. As a person who's just on the outside looking in, it seems that a lot of the solutions here lie within the institution. But how do I, as just Joe Blow citizen, what can I do to help alleviate some of these challenges? Is it looking at what our elected officials are doing? How much does politics, is there someone I need to vote out? Like, what can, do I show up to the hospital and try to protest? Like, what can we do as regular people to help be a part of the solution on this issue?
Yeah, so a couple of things. First of all, it's not just the blankets. The real money is the warm blankets. So make sure you ask for that next time.
Oh, nice. Electric.
It will change your life. It will change your life.
Nice.
So thank you all. You're very welcome for that tip. So what can the public do? A couple of things. One is, if you get great care at your facility, write the CEO of the hospital and mention the people who cared for you by name and tell them what a great job they did. And if you saw quality of care concerns, if you heard about mandatory overtime or unsafe staffing, put that in too and say, hey, this is not what I expect from my community hospital. Because they are accountable to the public. Most of our hospitals in the country are nonprofit and they're supposed to serve the community. So they need to respond to you. If you know a hospital executive, you can say, what are you doing to keep your nurses safe? And the answer shouldn't be pizza parties or coloring books. The answer should be eliminating mandatory overtime, humane staffing levels, and listening to nurses and acting on their issues. And do you have a safety committee for nursing and healthcare workers? We have patient safety committees in every hospital. Do we have a group of experts focused on healthcare worker safety? Missing piece. Finally, for the policy piece, couple points. Every state, healthcare, most hospital issues are managed at the state level. Moving throughout the country is legislation on penalizing verbal and physical abuses towards healthcare workers. Zero tolerance. You hit or strike a nurse or you call them a name, you're out. Full stop. We're not going to, you know, with limited circumstances, we are not obligated to treat you, and you can be charged with a crime. Also, mandatory staff, mandatory overtime and staffing ratios that are humane and safe. There's legislation in many states. California has a staffing mandate. Some states are working on banning mandatory overtime. We know those work. That keeps not only nurses safe, but it keeps patients safe. So those are the couple things. And then the final thing at the federal level, we talked about the nursing pipeline for faculty. We don't have enough funding to incentivize expert nurses to either stay at the bedside to teach or to teach in nursing schools. And if we want more nurses, that's where we need to start. And that's a solvable problem. We have money, right? I hope we have money. Mm-hmm. That's a money problem that we can solve. And our nursing schools, you know, we can work on our back end to make it work, that we can add, you know, bring more of those people in that we're turning away year after year after year.
Well, I'm happy that you are a nurse educator and that you're a nurse and that you're a doctor of nursing, because with a name like, you know, Dr. Freeze, you easily could have been a villain or some sort of comic book person that wreaked havoc on the city. But instead, you wreak love. Dr. Christopher Freeze, thank you so much for going beyond the scenes with us today. And Madeline, I will see you again on here, I don't know.
Fourth, I'll see you at the next pizza party, right? I'm just kidding.
We'll be right back with more of Guess What? Guess It. Yes, Beyond the Scene. That was a good guess. I knew you were smart.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Shout out to all our nurses out there who work long hours and who deserve way more than a pizza party. In this next clip, I chat with singer-songwriter Allo Black about how musicians have been getting shortchanged by the streaming industry and how he got involved in the fight. Better give us our money. I mean, I'm a comedian. I don't make as much streaming as musicians, but still, I want them 48 cents. It's my roll the clip. It's my money. I want it. I did not know that the number was $43 billion that the music industry brought in last year. Yet somehow, artists only got 12% of that. You wouldn't have this shit without us.
That's what I'm saying.
Especially now, because like back in the day, it seemed like, oh, well, music labels did work. You know, they got the records into the store and they did promotion and they, you know, they got it out there to people. But Alan, now you probably do a lot of that stuff yourself now, right?
Yeah, Allo, break this down. How did you get involved in this? Because I know that you were very vocal about this.
I got involved because I had one of the biggest songs in the world in 2013, 2014, Wake Me Up.
So wake me up when it's all over, when I'm wiser and I'm older. All this time I was finding myself and I didn't know I was lost.
And I was looking at the streams total and then looking at the money that came in from the streams total, and it just wasn't making sense. So I'm a songwriter and a singer. Not every artist who's singing their songs is also writing the songs. But when I looked at the math, it just wasn't adding up. You know, I'd rather have a dollar per download or somebody purchasing a CD than 0.004 cents for a stream. It's not a tenable situation for most of the artists.
Do you think, Allo, just as an artist, do you think that streaming, what are some of the pros of streaming? Do you think it saved the music industry to a degree? Because the music industry was taking a bath. And I know that's where a lot of those 360 deals came from, because the record labels figured out, oh, shit, we're not going to make any money off you from album sales. So I want a piece of your T-shirts and your Live Nation and all your tour dates. And then we'll make sure your song gets on the radio. So do you think streaming in a way saved the music industry?
I do give it some credit. So I was part of that Napster generation when I was in college. I was downloading all kinds of free music. And so it wasn't going to be possible for artists to make money if everybody's downloading the music for free. Having an organized system by which there is some sort of subscription paid, some money paid, will put money back into the system, then gets distributed to the artist. However, the way that the system works right now, isn't an equitable system. So I would give the streaming industry some credit for saving the music industry, but it was also in a moment where we're always rapidly transforming and progressing, evolving with technology. Things are always going to change. If we can have artists at the table, though, to make some of those decisions on how it changes, so that we can continue to offer value, really valuable music and art, then I think it'll make for a much more fair playing ground, you know.
Allo, what's different about this battle now? Because as far as I know, the record industry has always been shady. Is it the addition of the streamers now playing the role of co-conspirator? Or is it the fact that this system, this construct was kind of built before our eyes over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years?
Good question. It was built before our eyes. You saw it happening. What you didn't see was the inside baseball, where Spotify, looking like it's standing alone, is ultimately heavily, heavily invested in by the major record label corporations. So Spotify doesn't really have much say. And when I joined the fight, I was joining the fight really as a songwriter. Look, what is John Lennon or Paul McCartney without the lyrics and melody that they wrote, right? What is a song without the lyric and the melody? You could get a great Michael Jackson song,
correct,
and hear 300-400 different versions of it, right? At the end of the day, it's that unitary piece, that morsel, that nucleus, the songwriting. And when I learned that the songwriters get 1/14 of the income out of all this, I thought to myself, that doesn't make any sense. Where would the music industry be without that piece of intellectual property, the actual songwriting, the underlying work? And so I just started doing more digging and just getting involved in the fight.
Is the problem the rates paid per stream? Like, how do we make this more equitable?
The problem is the rates paid per stream. And the issue is that as an artist, as a businessman, right, I don't get to choose my price. Any other industry, you get to choose your price. As an entrepreneur, you get to say, this is what I'm willing to sell my wares for. And if there's a willing buyer, then so be it. If there's not, then I die by my own sword. And I want to be able to choose my price. You're going to tell me that Bill Withers' Lean On Me is worth 0.004 per stream, same as, I don't even want to name no artists right now, but you know, there's a gang of
Roy
artists.
Roy Wood Jr., you can just say it, Roy Wood Jr. comedy albums from Comedy Central. It's not the same price. It's fine. I'll lay on that grenade. It's fine.
Take the hit. Yes, you can take the hit. So you get me, right? And so what I think is,
yeah,
why can't Mr. Withers' estate say, nah, this is worth $4 a stream. And if you don't like it, so be it. But this is the price. It's not going down because this is what the worth is in terms of value, artistic credibility, authenticity, and what he delivered to the world. So, you know, if there's going to be a number, at least let the artists decide, and we can figure it out over time.
What can fans do in general? Because it, more often than not, this battle between artists and the record label, traditionally, as a fan, I've always felt helpless. Like when I, you can correct me, I'm sure you're more of a music encyclopedia than me, but I just won't name the artists. But I know that there have been traditionally a lot of rappers who speak out against their label and go, I'm only getting 50 cents a CD or a dollar a CD. And as a fan, the reaction from a lot of people, especially a lot of black people, a lot of hip hop fans, well, you shouldn't have signed that deal, not knowing the intricacies of how you get distribution and how you get in stores at that time. But it seems like distribution is less of a necessary need. So what can we as fans do to even try to help support artists other than just set up 8 laptops and just let all them shits play Allo Black?
The best thing that you could do to support fans is go directly to the fan, to the artist, for the merchandise that they're selling. The artist, if they have their own infrastructure, can deal with you on a one-to-one basis. There are, you know, many of the major artists have such a huge infrastructure around them that it's not going to be easy to do that. But for independent artists and up and coming artists, they generally have their own merch website where you can buy a t-shirt or whatever. They might be able to sell you a song one-to-one from their website as well, their Bandcamp or their TuneCore. And, you know, share their music. Share out the love and spread the gospel of what they're doing so that when we do open back up and people can get into concerts, they can get a chance to get that concert ticket money. That's definitely one of the plays for a lot of artists. I know a lot of artists that survive off of that touring money.
Here's a naive question, though. And this is coming from a guy that has seen people go viral on TikTok and Twitch and YouTube and IG stories with their own original stuff, who had no label, they had no support. What does the future of streaming look like? Because what is the advantage of a record label? If I, like right now, what's to stop me from going in the studio, getting my shit recorded and mastered, and then getting some ISRC code, digital footprint embedded in the track, and sending that out onto the internet and uploading that to set? Because there's ways for me to get on a streamer without a record label. I could just send my, like, there's digital distribution companies that'll just take a 30% pinch off of the dollar, and I get to keep 70 cents. So what's to stop an artist that's popular? Like, why do I need a label if everybody's listening to their stuff on a streamer anyway, and I can get to a streamer without a label?
Yes, that's a good question. Ultimately, the answer is whether or not you're going to be part of the global consciousness as an artist. You may be in for a second, for a hot minute with your hot song, but you know, these big boys are there to play. And if you want to get that radio, you're going to have to work with them, because this is the decades old kind of, you know, inside club. And then if you do have that one hit, they're going to come at you with a huge bag and be like, look, here's a huge amount of money that we're going to offer you to join our record label so that we could probably never pay attention to you again. And you probably won't get all this money. It's just promised to you over time if you perform. And so, you know, when you hear about these big multi-million dollar deals, these are usually spread out across 10 albums, you know, and multiple years. The artist doesn't necessarily see all that money. And you're looking at a lot of young cats who are flossing, but they're flossing. They got a bag, but they're flossing off of money that's not going to last forever. That's not forever, but ever money. Some of that's going to be gone. The reason why they end up going to the record labels is because they get that big, big paycheck in front of their face, rather than having to wait for the slow drip from the streams.
What does it take then? Because, you know, there's independent artists that have stayed independent, like two guys that I've enjoyed, one Immortal Technique, the other one Tech N9ne. And, you know, Tech N9ne is a rapper that, if you know him, you know him. He definitely does not get the spins on regular radio, but seems to have carved out a decent living for himself, and he's not going to get mobbed at the airport the way Drake or somebody from Young Money would or whatever. But why do you think that, or what does it take for the artists and the creators to realize that they're the ones with the power and not the labels and the radio stations?
It's going to take a lot of communication from, I'd say, the more mature and seasoned artists in the music industry to work with some of the younger ones and help them to recognize, you know, young cats, they're rebellious. They just want to do what they do and get their money. They're not really paying attention to the history of everything and where the trend is leading, or at least where the activism within the artistry is leaning. It's a tough battle. We're battling culture, cultural norms. We're battling some deep-seated industrial norms. And I just keep trying to stand up and speak my truth, you know.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg of the great guests and experts that we've had on the show. And when season 2 comes back around, oh man, we're going to have some more. Be sure to listen to The Daily Show Beyond the Scenes on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jon Stewart is back at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.